Welcome to the Nerveda podcast for complex health. We feature guests who dive deeply into the nuances of medicine with the goal of inspiring you to persistently heal in the face of inevitable challenge across the lifespan. This is about ancient and cutting-edge understandings of diseases and treatments, just as much as it is about food, lifestyle, nature, culture, and politics. I'm Jillian Ehrlich, family nurse practitioner, certified in Ayurveda and functional medicine, coming to you from our clinic on the shores of Lake Union, Nerveda Health, Seattle, Washington. And I am thrilled with our guest today. Dr. Paul Malcheski holds a BS degree in chemistry from St. Francis University, MS degrees in chemistry from Case Western Reserve University, and in chemical engineering from Cleveland State University, and a doctorate in engineering from Cleveland State University. He is president of the International Center for Artificial Organs and Transplantation, ICAOT, and consults for the chemical and medical industries. He's a former chief science officer of EnviroSystems, Inc., vice president of operations and discovery and development for Nanoscale Materials, Inc., a former vice president of investigational research and discovery and development at Steris Corporation, and a staff member at the Cleveland Clinic. While at the clinic, working with Dr. Yuki Noze, he was involved in the creation of the Artificial Organ Journal and the forming of ICAOT. He has carried out and directed research, development, manufacturing, quality control, and tech transfer in a variety of medical device and chemical-related areas, including artificial organ technologies, separation processes for diagnostic and therapeutic applications, including membrane application for dialysis, blood oxygenation, glucose sensing, and plasma separation, and its fractionation, apheresis, sorption applications for blood detoxification, magnetic technologies for biological cell separation, and nanomaterials. It is awesome, your history. He's published extensively in these fields with nearly 500 publications, holds 35 patents, and was co-editor of 4 books on apheresis. He is active in various professional societies and is the former editor-in-chief of Artificial Organs and managing editor of Therapeutic Apheresis and Dialysis. He is a past president of the American Society for Artificial Organs, Internal Organs, and past president of the International Society for Apheresis. He is an elected fellow to the American Institute for Medical and Biological Engineering and the Ohio Academy of Science. Recently, he developed the website icaot.org that you should visit. icaot.org discusses the history of the International Center for Artificial Organs and Transplantation and includes milestones in the field and invites contributions to its virtual collection. He is also actively seeking a new home for the center's artificial organ collection. So any listeners out there who have capacity to house that, please do reach out to him and let him know. And Dr. Malcheski, we're so happy to have you. Thanks for being here with us today.
Thank you, Jillian.
All right, so let's dive in. We got a lot to talk about today. Let's start with super basics. What is apheresis?
Apheresis comes from a Greek word meaning take away. And as it is applied to blood, it means take away certain components of the blood. So if we take away the red blood cells, that's referred to as erythrocytopheresis, and take away leukocytes, leukocytopheresis, and take away plasma, it's called plasmapheresis. So it's a very old term and used in varying ways, but in our discussion today, we're applying it to blood. So.
Blood. Okay, so apheresis, it means removal of components from the blood. And how did people come up with this idea? What's the history of apheresis?
Well, the history is quite old. I looked through some of my notes and some of the milestones listed on our website. And around 1000 BC,
wow,
priests in ancient Egypt applied bloodletting to treat many diseases. By bloodletting, they meant they would allow blood to be taken from a person. Around 500 BC, bloodletting spread to Greece and the ancient world. And in medieval times, bloodletting was predominantly used by the barber surgeon. So you understand the concept of the barber pole today, the red and white stripes on it, that had its origination from the barbers who were surgeons in medieval times. And if you looked and read books about the in medieval time, you may remember Don Quixote, when he was riding his horse through the countryside. He wore a hat, and it was actually a bloodletting bull that he had on
Oh,
his head.
really?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. In the early 1700s, bloodletting reached its height in popularity, but in that time and the prior and in the previous time, people always thought there was something in the body, these bad humors that they had to get out of, and their approach to that was trying to take these humors out of the blood, and that was by bloodletting. In 1902, Hedin discovered plasmapheresis when he auto transfused a body's own erythrocytes, red blood cells, into rabbits.
Whoa.
So obviously, looking at a way to improve the therapy. In 1909, Flieg reported the first therapeutic approach of apheresis with an auto transfusion with washed blood cells in toxemia. And he transfused these to treat anemia. So even at this time, people were recognizing that there were toxins building up in the body, and one way to get rid of them, of course, would be by bloodletting or apheresis. And right around this time, the dialysis was invented. 1913, Abel Rowntree and Turner described the principle of hemodialysis. And this was the first known hemodialysis procedure was done on dogs. And of course, from 1913 till 1943, when the first clinical hemodialysis was carried out by Colt, it's quite a long time. So a lot of things had to happen for this technology, even for hemodialysis, to make it practical. At that time, he also studied, this is 1913, he also studied the effect of plasma removal in dogs, and he created the term plasmapheresis. Now we jump ahead to 1926. Again, be mindful that a lot of things have to happen for a procedure to be applicable. In 1926, Gilbert, Vanek, and Negroni described plasmapheresis applied to humans. So this is the first known record that we have of that. In 1944, Dewey, Bartlett, Wright, and Holt were the first to carry out plasma separation using centrifuges. The technology of developing the centrifuge is quite interesting also, but it was a procedure based upon the density difference of the cells in the blood compared to the plasma. They could separate the cells and collect the plasma. So we thought that was rather interesting. I think maybe for modern day technology, we might jump a little bit further ahead. But I wanted to mention, though, there were in reviewing the history of bloodletting, there were a lot of cutting devices that were available. Matter of fact, I had a friend from Poland who actually gave me a cutting device
Really?
that was used to cut little slices into the arm. And when I visited there, I actually went to a pharmacy and I found cupping devices. These were devices in which you would warm up the cup, and then you'd place it on the body, and it would suck blood into the skin and pull it away from the circulation. And they believed that had some beneficial effects. Matter of fact, this friend of mine from Poland actually treated his young child with cupping because he had a serious infection. Another thing that people will remember are the use of leeches. People use leeches to suck on the tissue on your skin and pull out blood. So here I think the concept was that people wanted to stir up the pot, in a way, when you're cooking, you want to stir it up to mix it a little bit. And by removing blood and pulling blood to the extremities, I think that was a way that they could do that with the technology available. And from a recollection, from our own history, I understand George Washington was treated by bloodletting, and that may have led to his death because people were unable to control the process of how much blood to take. And when they were doing bloodletting, they were also discarding many important cells, like the red blood cells, which are important for providing oxygen to the tissue. So they were overdoing it. It wasn't selective separation. In 1968, and I know he started a little bit earlier, Dr. George Judson from the IBM Corporation and his associates developed a closed centrifuge which allowed the separation of plasma from the cellular components in a discontinuous and then in a later continuous way. It's interesting because sometimes technology is developed out of need. And Dr. Judson had a young son who was diagnosed with leukemia, and he was referred to the clinical center at the National Cancer Institute at the National Institutes of Health. And when he was admitted, they showed Dr. Judson the procedure of removing the white blood cells for his son.
Mm-hmm.
And they would basically collect 2 units of blood, spin them in a bucket centrifuge at that time, and then collect the plasma into a bag and the white cells, and then discard the white cells, and then put the plasma back with the red blood cells and give it back to his son.
Let's talk about what is in blood, because if we're talking about like kind of the different components that come out, let's talk a little bit about what is in blood. What is in blood?
Well, blood has two major components, the cells and the plasma. And then, and the plasma contains all the clotting factors. So when you go and give a sample of blood, like for a blood test,
mm-hmm.
you notice that they'll allow the blood to sit and clot, and then they spin out what they call serum. So serum mm-hmm. is plasma minus the clotting factors.
Mm-hmm.
So the blood is really composed then of a liquid portion, what we call the plasma, and the cellular portion, which include the red blood cells, white blood cells, and the platelets.
Mm-hmm.
Red blood cells are very important for carrying oxygen, you know, to the body. They pick up oxygen and dispose of CO2. And the white blood cells are, of course, you know, for preventing infections. And the platelets are for clotting purposes.
Mm-hmm.
So two major components, though. But when you separate in a centrifuge, you basically separate out, are able to divide the cellular components into different fractions.
Mm-hmm.
And so with a continuous blood flow centrifuge, you're able to pull off the red blood cells, the white blood cells, if you wish, and a white buffer coat to include the platelets or the plasma portion of it. And when you're treating or in the procedure, you're typically anticoagulating the blood with an anticoagulant like citrate or heparin. And so that prevents the blood from clotting.
Mm-hmm.
And so by giving the anticoagulant and by tapping into the vessel, running tubes from the, you know, from the vessel to the machine, one's able to separate the blood into its components.
And I remember that one of the interesting things about leeches is that they actually have an anticoagulant like in their saliva, so that when
they
a
do.
Leech
That's
bites
correct.
You, they infuse some anticoagulant, and that's how they continue kind of pulling blood out. And even as late as when I was working at Harborview Medical Center downtown Seattle, we occasionally used leeches. The pharmacy would send them up in little plastic cups, in little specimen cups with holes poked in the top.
Right.
And we used them for like if patients had, say, a finger chopped off and then reattached, then you need perfusion. You need better perfusion of blood into that digit. And so we would apply the leeches until they were so full, and then we would pull them off. But we would use that as a way to kind of that the blood thinner that the leeches infuse, and then the leech would pull blood into that digit, so it would actually get better perfusion. Really fascinating.
Right.
I mean, it was
Yeah.
like 2000, and I was there as late as 2000, and I think I left in 2011. So this is not that long ago that we were still occasionally using leeches for therapeutic purposes in like mainstream big inner city hospitals.
Yeah, that's interesting. When I some of the old pottery, you can see they have leeches labeled on it, and
Oh,
these
maybe.
were used in pharmacies where they would put the leeches in these crocks, you know. And I guess you go and you buy how many you wanted at that time. But I think leeches were also valuable. In my work in infection control, they were applied to patients to actually eat up the infected wound areas.
Oh,
So
that's
I
interesting.
don't know if that's still being used today or not, but that it was a
That's
very
funny.
effective way of cleaning the wound.
Interesting. And
So.
even before that, you talked about 1000 BC from, our practice includes Ayurveda. And in the Ayurvedic tradition, which is said to be, 4,000, 5,000, or maybe even 10,000 years old, there's a whole term called Rakta Moksha. Rakta meaning blood and moksha meaning liberation. And so
Oh,
it's one of the kind of five classic detoxification processes is the blood is called blood, translates out of the Sanskrit to blood liberation.
you think that was bloodletting?
They would, I think, mostly leeches in India, but I don't know. I don't know kind of the traditional details around that. That would be interesting to find out.
Yeah, it goes way back.
It goes way back, yes. And so this technology, what's amazing about this technology is that we actually don't have to pull out all of the blood to pull out some of those factors in the blood to be able to separate the blood. So that's, I think, where you were getting to in the 60s with
Yeah, well,
centrifuge.
it took centuries and centuries, right, to get to that point where people recognized that we should keep the good stuff and get rid of the bad stuff.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
So that's, I think that's what, but I wanted to point out that, and I give a lot of credit to the IBM Corporation for allowing Dr. Judson to take his time to build this machine. And I actually had the opportunity to meet him in the early 70s. I was working with a development on blood oxygenation using a liquid fluorocarbon, trying to oxygenate whole blood. And we visited their laboratory, and using a centrifugal approach to try to keep the fluorocarbon liquid away, from getting into the blood. So it's very good. Well, and it also points out the need for technology for companies to get involved in this, because without their help, it's very difficult for individual researchers, I think, at institutions to be able to do work like this. So,
Absolutely.
I'll jump ahead a little bit. In 72, we were doing work in our laboratory trying to oxygenate blood, and we're using a hollow fiber device. I don't know if people know what hollow fibers are, but we can talk about that a little bit if you wish. And we were running the blood through there and trying to oxygenate the blood. But what happened was it was leaking. It was leaking fluid. So it's supposed to be hydrophobic, so it doesn't leak water. And it was hydrophilic, meaning it loved water. And that gave us the idea that we could probably use membrane systems, to do this, to separate plasma. It took a few years for that to happen, but in between, our group was working on developing a flat plate device for membrane plasma separation. And the reason there was we wanted to have particle-free liquid coming out. The plasma had to be particle-free. We didn't want any, in centrifuge devices at that time, there would always be some cell carryover. So you would have these cells that could contaminate then, the patient. And we wanted to treat the patient with using the plasma, but we wanted to run the plasma through sorbent devices to remove toxins. So we wanted a particle-free solution, and we thought membrane technology would be the way to do that. So.
And can I ask, like in the early 70s, what was being treated? What kinds of patients were these that you were looking at this technology for?
Well, we were our focus was on liver failure.
Okay, gotcha.
We were looking at treating patients who were had high bilirubin levels and bile acid levels. We actually treated some patients who actually went into coma, and We could pull the patient out of coma by treating for very long periods of time using sorbent devices like charcoal and resins, where we ran the plasma over and it would draw up the toxins. And it was amazed that one lady just woke up during the procedure. But so that was our focus, because our group had some background history in liver support. But at that time, there were others doing plasmapheresis, plasma separation, primarily, and they were treating a lot of different diseases. I think in 1981, we actually reported and reviewed there was like 40 different diseases that were being treated, or people had reported treated up until that time. And of course, we reported many years later, there was over 100 different diseases that people were treating. So,
And were those diseases like neoplastic, like cancers, blood cancers? Were they lipid disorders? Were they autoimmune? Were they neurodegenerative?
this is in 1981. We had a panel discussion at the American Society for Artificial Internal Organs, and we invited the people from the center in Munich, University of Munich. We had the National Institutes of Health represented, Cleveland Clinic, and a group from Tokyo Women's Medical College. And at that time, there were about 40 diseases being treated. Some of those were recognized as being at that time already proven. Others were considered justified, others promising, and others maybe possible.
Do you have kind of recorded any examples of what those diseases, those 40 diseases were?
Yes, I do. There were these were procedures used in the United States around 1981. Actually, I have a article I can send you, or I don't know if I sent you this article concerning this session at the meeting, but it lists what the medical disciplines were: hematology, rheumatology, nephrology, neurology, oncology, and others. And at that time, we had estimated about 180,000 patients were being treated at that time, and we have a list of the various numbers for the different diseases. At
Yeah. So
that time, there were oncology was looked at as being one of the largest because they were treating multiple myeloma as a disease. But I can send you that. If I haven't sent that to you, I'll send that to you.
Okay, that'd be great. And I'm happy I can post it with this. When we post the podcast, I'll post the article as well.
Yeah. So the focus at that time was, in trying to develop devices that would be that we thought, would be cleaner to use and cleaner in the sense of not having that cellular carryover. And so we thought the membrane technology might be useful. And we collaborated then with companies in Germany and Japan and actually bet them, see who could come up with the best device in the shortest period of time.
Great.
So as part of my work, we looked at probably a half a dozen different devices made from different polymers from different companies. And we actually reached a point where essentially all of those devices could perform at the same level in terms of getting a 99% plus plasma, meaning albumin would pass through it, immune globulins could pass through it. And so we were pretty comfortable at that time and refining the process of how to do this clinically, because the history of plasmapheresis kind of rides, or plasma separation kind of rides on the history of dialysis, where people were used to using high pressures to remove fluid from patients in a dialysis procedure. So in dialysis, you're trying to remove small molecules that build up because your kidneys no longer function. There's water buildup, there's electrolytes buildup. So those are the main interest in the procedure. So when we would allow give these filters to people that worked in dialysis, their point was that to get a lot of fluid off, you have to use a lot of pressure. And so we worked with developing the clinical procedures to be able to control the pressure of operation for these medical filters. And we're able to reach a very high level of performance, almost to the point where you could, you know, concentrate your blood to a very high percentage of red blood cells. So the point being that we thought we were very, the membrane technology could be very competitive to the centrifugal technology, with the advantages we thought were you didn't have, you had the cell-free solution that you were generating. Plus, you then could use this procedure to treat the plasma for which you have separated, as opposed to throwing the plasma away and replacing it with like an albumin solution. You could use other technologies to treat the to treat that. So there, a lot was going on, and from surveys that we had done, we found that it depended upon what technology was available in the various countries. And so we would always say we're relatively technology poor in the United States in terms of the apheresis technology, because we didn't have a lot of the things that the Japanese and the Germans were able to do in terms of sorbent devices and filters, membrane filter technology that could be applied in this. So there was always that back and forth of what's a better way to go, and obviously the controversy between centrifugal versus membrane. And also, if you did your work in a blood for therapeutic apheresis, if you did your work in a blood bank, you would be using a centrifugal process. If you did your work in dialysis, like as the dialysis center, and then doing apheresis, you would be using membrane devices. So it was more attuned to the technology, you know, that was available in the different centers that were applying the, they were wanting to do the procedures. There were also differences in the type of anticoagulation. If you did centrifugal procedures, you would give citrate to prevent coagulation. But if you worked in dialysis and used and used membrane devices for apheresis, you would use heparin as the anticoagulation. So that kind of complicates things also when you're starting to compare procedures done in different countries by different technologies in terms of how the patients did on those different procedures. It was not really fair to compare exactly, because there were other things that were being done that could have had an impact on the outcome of that procedure. So we thought that if you had the plasma, now you could treat it different ways. And so we developed the sorbent methods using charcoals and resins. But then we also looked at filtration as a way to remove what we called macromolecules. In dialysis, the interest is primarily in removing small molecules. There's a lot of debate in that field, though, about so-called middle molecules and importance of removal. But we know from some patients can live 30 and 40 years on dialysis, and yet you have such a simple procedure of removing small molecules, and they're surviving. So it's, you know, it's a very different type procedure. But when in these diseases that we were looking at, we were trying then to identify as early as, you know, the early 1980s and late 70s, what did we want to remove from these different diseases? And so we started to identify specific proteins in general that were accumulating in patients with certain diseases. And as an example, in rheumatoid arthritis, there were buildup of proteins, and we found in some patients cryoproteins, and others, various immune globulins. So to do our research, we went to the blood bank where they were doing their pheresis, you know, and centrifugal procedures, and we collected the bags of the plasma they were going to throw away anyway, because they're replacing the plasma, you know, with albumin solution. Generally, that was the case. So we were collecting all these plasmas. We had so many of them from patients getting treated for different diseases. We just put them in our refrigerator. And
Mm-hmm.
then when we went to go look at them to see, to start doing our experimental bench work, we found there was all this crud on the bottom, this stuff that was sinking and sedimenting. And so we started, we analyzed that procedure, those chemistries, and found that those were called cryoproteins. But what before we did our treatment, we would take the plasma out of the refrigerator, would warm it up. We found that those precipitates disappeared. So we had now a clear plasma for which to do our experimental work, not recognizing that these could have been the culprits that we were looking for. So that led us to developing a procedure called cryofiltration, where we cooled the plasma online, and we would then run it through the filter and then run it back to the patient. And in my own experience, we could see the gelling of these and precipitates forming in the line. In some cases, not precipitates per se, but cloudiness occurring in the line of these patients, of these patients. So that led to development of cryofiltration. We went on to use that to treat multiple diseases, including rheumatoid arthritis.
Do you see those cryoproteins across disease processes like rheumatology, neurology, nephrology? Like, do you see those cryoprecipitates in multiple
We found
conditions?
them in a lot of in a lot of the plasmas that we had, and so we didn't understand it. So I ended up researching what were cryoproteins, and I wrote an article at the Cleveland Clinic with a immunologist, and we talked about the different types of cryoprotein and how they were recognized as being, prognostic, that people with these, years, decades later would develop diseases and debilitating diseases, and including liver failure. So we thought that we might have been on to something. And the interesting point about the cryoproteins, they're not so much different than the normal proteins, except there might have been some, changes in their amino acid composition, just enough to make them susceptible to form precipitates in the cold. And some patients, even when you did a centrifugal separation of their blood, they would have what would be called a cryocrit. And it could have been as high as, I don't know, 5, 10%. So in addition to seeing the red blood cells separate and the plasma separate, you'd see this big band of white, which was a cryoprecipitate, which was protein that was aggregated. So, we started running, we probably did more testing of that than anybody else in the whole hospital, because we were researching it. But
Do you think,
we found that many people had this and didn't even know it.
interesting. And like, how would that impact, a human body is like warm. Like we're warm-blooded mammals. So I'm just curious where, like, how does that cooling fit in with, a warm-blooded mammal? Is it like, would you
Well,
see her with like gray nodes
it's the
and
reason with people who have diseases that have cryos that go to Florida because it's warmer there. But we see people who have Raynaud's, people who have temperature sensitivity, particularly in the extremities, primarily in the fingertips, And what happens is these cryoproteins start gelling and they plug up the vessels, and they prevent flow into the extremities.
Got it.
So that's so people, when they have cold sensitivity, says, go ask your doctor to do a cryoprotein analysis. And they typically don't, because I don't think they do that many, and I think they're afraid to ask their doctor to do that. But I actually had a cryofiltration procedure done on me before we started patient treatments, and I found that I had a little bit of cryo in my blood also.
Interesting.
And after the treatment, it was reduced more than 50%. So
Did you
we
notice
were.
any clinical changes in yourself after that reduction?
No,
Like,
I not at that time. I didn't notice. But I think if as years, as you age, I think you build up these proteins, and you're not able to get rid of them, and I think they accumulate, and they probably have lead to some more debilitating diseases. And so the idea then was to look at filtration ways of removing these proteins so that we didn't have to have replacement fluid, and also to do it online to prevent any contamination of the plasma. And so a lot of focus went on the development of filtration methodologies, and developing filters that we could do this procedure in a reasonable time period. In our first clinical case, we treated a patient with rheumatoid who I put two filters in line for the treatment, and we plugged up the first filter very quickly. And so we had a switch to the second filter. So depends upon the patient. Some had very high level, and others had, maybe no or very low levels. But and I mentioned also the fact that we were using heparin as an anticoagulant, and heparin complexes with some of these proteins to cause complexes to be formed that make it and made it easier for us to remove them, we believe. And we did a lot of work on the extracts from these filters, what we call the cryogels, that was precipitated in these filters, and analyzed them to, to learn what was, what their compositions were. Many of them contained antibodies and things of that sort, and immune complexes that were very critical and maybe causative of the difficulty of that disease state. So we, another area topic in the early 80s, probably late 70s, early 80s, was high cholesterol in patients, and what do we do for, prevention of atherosclerosis. So we started investigating that and developed a procedure called thermofiltration. And the idea here was that we don't want to cool it, because if we cooled it, we would form this, potentially form a mass of proteins that will plug the filter. And in these patients, it was primarily the cholesterol which we're interested in removing. And if you look at cholesterol under a microscope, the HDL cholesterol, which is the good cholesterol, is relatively small compared to the bad cholesterol, the LDL and the VLDL fractions. So it looked like, wow, if we could get a filter that could separate between the good and the bad, that would be perfect. And of course, right around this time, new drugs were coming out due to treat cholesterol. But the fact was that we could, and we showed in animals, a homozygous, this is a an animal bred to have both genes that favor the production of very high cholesterol levels. And so the animals were, leveled like 500 or 600, maybe 700. Normal cholesterol is probably should be below 50 in an animal. And we were able to actually show that we could stop the progression of atherosclerosis by removing the this cholesterol fraction from these animals. We couldn't show regression, but we could show we could stop the progression. And other people, later showed that they could actually cause regression of atherosclerosis by the removal of cholesterol. So as I mentioned before, by early 1980s, we found over 40 different diseases treated by plasma exchange, primarily therapeutic apheresis, but mainly it was called plasma exchange because that's the method was being used. And then over the course of years, I did a survey again, maybe a decade and a half later, and it was like over 100 diseases that were where the occurrence of where patients were being treated, but also the identification of molecules, macromolecules in the plasma of these patients was also shown. So our objective was to not just do these procedures, but to try to treat patients who had known levels of these macromolecules, believing that if it's high in the blood, it's probably not normal. If it's not normal, then it probably shouldn't be there. using the same rationale that maybe dialysis was being chosen for treatment of chronic kidney failure too. Where are we? You probably.
So we're kind of through the 80s. So I'm curious, once we get into like the 90s and the 2000s, where, like, what does it look like kind of in the last 15 years, apheresis?
Well, I think it in the last decade and a half or so, people continue to apply it. They apply differently depending on where you are, not only by the procedures, but by the, by the belief. Japan versus Europe versus the United States, the thoughts are a little bit differently. The United States, the American Society for Apheresis has a they publish an article, I think it's every year, that talks about the which are recommended, like a maybe a first level of treatment, and which are probable, which ones you shouldn't bother treating with apheresis. So different guidelines have been established, and the Japanese have also established guidelines. They're different than what the United States has. Likewise, in Europe and primarily in Germany, they set guidelines by which they're treating, and the guidelines are, in put there, I think, primarily because of the medical reimbursement, for the healthcare system. Who's going to pay for these procedures? And they don't want to be paying for procedures that are, considered not to be effective. So. So I think the work is going on, probably since I've been involved, actively involved, the number of centers carrying out procedures have probably increased. As I mentioned from the surveys in the United States, it's primarily by centrifugal procedures, and you'll find in Germany and Europe in general, and Japan, probably by membrane technology would be applied there.
And so, and in terms of, so we're seeing more and more procedures being done. The last survey that we have, the last international survey, was from 2007. And we had a, there was about a 20% response rate and about 7,000, almost 7,000 treatments completed. So we can look at, kind of how much this is happening, clearly a lot more than that. I'm curious, your sense of safety with this type of a procedure.
Safety is pretty good. I mean, it's done properly. It's done. It's a very safe procedure. As I mentioned, I had myself carried out two procedures. I had two procedures done on me. Those were membrane procedures for cryofiltration, one for thermofiltration for cholesterol, and they were carried out with heparin as an anticoagulant. I had just a needle puncture in the arm to pull the blood, so the blood flow was not real high, but it was adequate. In the surveys that we've conducted, the and generally there's a lot of safety to that. We did record one death, I believe. I don't know much about the specifics on that, but usually the procedures are the difficulties associated with the procedure are the blood access, and sometimes complications with the anticoagulant, in particular when citrate is being used. And of course, the blood pressure changes because of blood that's being drawn from the body and then returned. So I think medical practice, I think the way it's performed today and under the controls, I think it would be a relatively safe procedure. And I would not hesitate to have a procedure done on myself, and as I have, to prove the point.
And as you and I have talked about in other times, we are now seeing that with these macromolecules, and what's been really fascinating to me and everything that you've said is that from the very beginning, there's been a recognition that the macromolecules that are produced that we are considering, like,
a toxin to the system, a metabolic waste, essentially, that's potentially building up, can present in all the different silos of medicine. So nephrology, hepatology, you know, liver, rheumatology, immunology, neurology, you know, all these different elements, in addition to oncology, in addition to the multiple myeloma. And so one of the things that we are now starting to see is that these apheresis treatments are being used for longevity, because as we have noticed, there is somewhat of a, you know, there's a range, there's one scale along which kind of complex and chronic disease, but also aging is occurring. And so we're now seeing people starting to use these apheresis treatments as longevity treatments and anti-aging treatments, which I would be very curious to see the research on. You know, we know that people have, you can check biomarkers for decades before a disease actually presents.
Well, a good example was the cryoprotein. Mm-hmm. It predicted, you know, disease in patients that had the cryoproteins in their system at a much younger, you know, very young age.
Yeah. 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 So I think, you know, it'll be really interesting to see where this technology goes and how it ends up being implemented. And we know that we're living in a more and more toxic world. We know that there's more and more pollution that our bodies are having to, you know, encounter and digest and try and eliminate.
Yeah, I think our body responds to these environmental changes, and it, you know, it does so by producing ways to protect itself. And in many ways, disease it's a protection. The body's trying to protect itself, but it becomes overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
And I use the example of, you know, how do you put out a fire in a room when it's filled with smoke and you don't know where to spill, you know, spray the water? And so what do? You flood the whole room, or do you clear the smoke and then treat the fire with a little bit of water, you know?
Yeah.
So I think we're playing games. I don't know, game's not the right word, but we're treating things in a way that is more than that might be required. Like, you know, for example, drug therapies, you know, maybe we're taking more than what we need because we have to compensate for some other things. And I was asked to present at a meeting now more than a few years ago, and I wrote, the topic was aging, disease, and therapeutic apheresis. And I, in researching for that presentation, I found that the body has ways of removing toxins, but they can get overwhelmed. And there's a group of cells called senescent cells,
mm-hmm.
that I don't know much about them, but their job was to remove some of these toxins. But if they get overwhelmed, they're not able to do it. So the mm-hmm. body then kind of gives up. The body is amazing. It has so much capacity. You know, you think that you can, you know, breathe, just sitting, and then your heart rate speeds up when you're doing a marathon, you know, so mm-hmm. to allow you to have that capacity to get the oxygen and excrete the things that are necessary. So the body is really amazing how it's built and designed, but it's also maybe programmed for death in a sense, it's producing those things that eventually get us. And, and we talk, you know, we look at what some of these debilitating diseases. I'm reminded of this patient that we first treated for rheumatoid. She already had implants, you know, joint implants, and had very crippling, mm-hmm. you know, joints. And so the rheumatoid arthritis led to joint destruction. And so
mm-hmm.
if we don't correct some of these things early, it's only going to get worse.
Mm-hmm. It's very true. It's very true.
I don't know if it's what the effect on aging might be, but our whole hope was to just live a better life, you know?
Yes.
A healthier life. And the other thing to point out is that with pheresis, the effects were not totally understood. When mm-hmm. we would study some of these extracted toxins that we got from these filters and studied them with cells. And we did this on different occasions. And we could see how they were impairing the function of normal cells. And so if you imagine if your body is living in this milieu of toxins, what's it doing to the cells? You know, they're not functioning, you know, like they should. So many people believe, you know, maybe cell therapy is a way to do, you know, everything's related to the cells. You know, the cells produce antibodies and they can remove toxins, but maybe it's the toxin that is, you know, should be removed, and maybe the cells would function better. So once you're able to clear some of the smoke, I think the body is able to help itself, help in the repair. And, you know, so you need to help it along, you know, in a sense, you know, help it to do its job when it's having difficulty performing its normal functions.
Absolutely. 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 And, you know, that is the goal, that apheresis is part of a larger program, so that we're not just pulling off either toxins or immunoglobulins, that we are, you know, that we're helping people renovate their health from the very foundation, from diet, lifestyle, from kind of understanding about the world, from the environment, you know, all the elements together. So really fascinating.
I just thought of something else that the I talked about the cryoproteins, but in cardiology now and in atherosclerosis, there's this molecule called LP little a, right. Lipoprotein little a, and it's not, I don't think it's studied much, or it's not as part of my routine blood work, but in and of itself, it's a you know, an indicator of heart disease. And what is it? It's just a big cholesterol molecule, bigger than the LDL, something that could be readily removed by apheresis. And the other thing is, one has to be concerned about is when one does therapeutic apheresis, one is throwing a lot of good away, a lot of good things away with the bad things. And typically the replacement fluid is an albumin solution, you know, in saline, and we may not be making up for all the things that we've lost. So our whole objective was to try to get rid of the bad, only save the good. And I think we need to better define technologies and develop technologies to be able to do that.
Yeah, that is an interesting place for technology to go next. I mean, I feel, thinking back to the beginning of our show here today, you know, we're able to save so much more than when George Washington was being bloodlet. Right. So we've come a long way, but there's definitely, you know, the technology, I think, is going to, I agree with you, is going to continue to advance and improve over the next, you know, couple decades. So that is definitely.
I have another thought on clinical trials, if you want to speak about that.
Sure.
We struggled when we were trying to set up a trial for patients in apheresis, and so our first big patient population was the rheumatoid patients, and we thought we had, you know, thought we had something good for them, but we didn't really know what was the best protocol to use. How often do we treat them? How much plasma do we treat in any given period of time? How do we assess the effects of drug therapy at the same time as doing the treatment, and what are the long-term effects? So we got criticized, you know, appreciably for initially reporting even on the treatment of a rheumatoid patient, but we didn't see where other people understood what would be the best way to design that protocol. So we did what we called were uncontrolled trials to begin with. You know, our first patient, we did 3 times a week, then we started less patients that weren't as bad as our first, who had already joint replacements. We looked at 2 times a week, and then we did it for how many, you know, X amount of weeks. And and then we didn't know if that was enough either. And so our experience was that we treated patients and we tried to wean them off the patients over a course of time, and eventually didn't provide the patient, you know, the treatment at all, because they were they were doing, better than, appreciably better than what we started. So I think the big problem is the design of clinical trials in these diseases, and they're pretty complex, and there's a lot of different variables associated with them that one has to control for.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, absolutely. Well, any last thoughts today before we close?
I think those might have been my last thoughts. I wanted to make sure that we talked about difficulties in control trials and developing control trials and individualizing the therapy in patients.
Yeah.
What might be needed, because one procedure or one protocol may not be best for everybody. But I think you need to have markers. I think that you don't do it blindly. I'd prefer to see the treatments done where you know that you had something to measure. For example, in rheumatoid, we could measure immune globulins. So we actually did kinetic studies on studying the production of immune globulins. And like in dialysis, you measured, urea, creatinine, the water loss, and dialysis and therapeutic apheresis. We need to find those markers. We probably need to individualize the treatment based upon that. Not only chemical markers, but physical markers. For example, in rheumatoid patients, we looked at walking time, looked at, their grip strength and things of that, the things that are important to them for their function. So it's a lot of things to look at. And unfortunately, the way the world goes, there's not a lot of money to do a lot of things. So you have to be thinking through some of these to short circuit your ability to get to trials that are very meaningful, I think, and that would make a significant impact, not just a marginal impact.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. Great. Dr. Malcheski, thank you so much for being here with us today. And if you are interested in reaching out to Dr. Malcheski or helping him find a home for the center's artificial organ collection, please do reach out at icaot.org. And we love that you've joined us here today to discuss how to make our whole world medicine. We rise or fall together, and we're committed to doing what we can to make as many of us as healthy as possible. And this takes all of us, including you. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time.